I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is Dunwoody, Georgia. The city is now a northern suburb of Atlanta, formally established in 2008, but the community was first created in the early 1830s. From its earliest days, Dunwoody was a center of commerce, and when a railroad was built between neighboring Roswell and Atlanta, the entire area benefited from increased trade and an influx of new residents. The region continued to grow and prosper ever since, with a current population of more than 54,000 residents. Today, the city enjoys a prime location as part of the greater Atlanta area and serves as the headquarters to many large companies. And with 72% of the population having earned bachelor's degrees, there is an abundance of educated workers. Even as Dunwoody continues to experience significant growth, it is considered a safe city to live and consistently appears on the list of safest cities in Georgia. But in 2010, this idyllic tableau proved to be fragile and was shattered when a brutal and violent murder was committed in broad daylight and in front of a preschool.
It was around 9 a.m. on November 18th, 2010, when the Dunwoody police started getting a flood of 911 calls coming in. All of the calls said the same thing. Somebody had been shot in front of the Dunwoody preschool. They heard a number of shots. One man called and actually said he had seen the man, described him to police. He didn't get a tag number, but said it was a white minivan that pulled out of the parking lot after the shots were heard. EMTs responded very quickly and found the man in the parking lot where he had been shot. He was bleeding profusely, and all they were focused on was getting him into the ambulance and to a hospital as quickly as they could. When police arrived, they started talking to the witnesses who were there. They all said the same thing. It looked to be a middle-aged man. He had a ski cap on, a very dark beard, kind of medium weight. But one of them actually said that the beard looked fake. It looked like he was trying to be a black man, when in fact, he was probably a white man. And there were three or four people who had seen this person. They all agreed that the beard looked fake, but they sat down with a sketch artist to get this person's face out into the public. All four of the witnesses said the same thing. This man got out of his car, walked straight up to the other man who was getting into his car, fired the shots at him, turned around, walked back to his car, and drove away. Tragically, when the EMTs were able to get this man to the hospital, the doctors pronounced him dead.
Russell Schneiderman grew up in Cleveland, Ohio with a brother, and he went to Indiana University where he met his wife, Andrea, when he was 18 years old. So after getting married, they moved to Boston so Rusty could get his MBA from Harvard.
Same.
Because he was a slacker.
Same.
Exactly. Exactly. And he and his wife wound up having two children. At the time Russell was murdered, his son was 1.5 years old, and it was the little boy that he was dropping off at the preschool just before he was shot. His daughter was 4.5, and fortunately, she was not there that morning. Rusty and Andrea were very active at their synagogue and involved in philanthropic circles. And at the time he was killed, he was in the process of trying to start a financial services business. Investigators come to the scene, of course, and they recover shell casings, so they know that the murder weapon is a .40 caliber gun. They speak to witnesses, as you said, and one of the things that I saw, Kath, I watched an interview from one of the witnesses, and he said that he saw it happen, and it was like a scene in a movie. His brain couldn't process what he was seeing. He literally thought they were filming a movie. And he only realized that it was an actual murder when the killer got into the minivan and had problems reversing out of the parking lot. Like he was trying to like go backward really fast or something. And the witness was like, oh my God, this is real. That man was really just killed. Because apparently after he does the last shot, the shooter just simply turned around and calmly walked back to his car. It was him getting in the car and trying to get out of that parking lot that alerted the eyewitness. Exactly. Made it real.
Can you imagine though? Like that is your brain protecting yourself. You know, like.
Totally. How can you process that?
Especially in this day and age with video games and YouTube and everything that desensitizes us to that kind of violence.
Yeah.
You don't want to think it's ever real.
Like you're used to seeing extreme things. So detectives speak with the preschool workers. It actually was also a daycare. And Kathy and I were mildly amused that it was called Dunwoody Prep. And we were like, what are they prepping them for?
Well, and we think that's why the 4.5-year-old wasn't there.
Right.
We think she'd been prepped and might have been in 7th grade.
Exactly. Exactly. Anyways.
It's very fancy. It means they can charge more.
Exactly. Yeah. So she was so prepped that she was off to kindergarten.
Exactly.
Anyway, so the detectives speak with the employees and the employees say that no stranger tried to get into the daycare.
Right.
No one tried to get into the building. So detectives were eliminating the possibility that this was actually someone whose intended target was a child or children. Right.
Like maybe to custodial parents, something like that.
Exactly.
Or non-custodial parents.
Exactly. Like, is somebody having an ugly divorce and, you know, did things go south? Detectives noticed that they did have one camera that was trained on the parking lot.
And the front door. So it wasn't the streets out around it. It was very concentrated on where it was.
Right. And so they get the footage from the school and realize it was very low quality footage. And so they sent it to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, hoping for their help in
cleaning it up.
Exactly. The police released the composite sketch that Kathy referenced earlier, and a woman called in and said, hey, I just saw someone that looks exactly like this guy in the sketch. So detectives immediately rushed to the lady. They approached the man. It turns out
he looked exactly like the sketch.
Exactly. But he was in the military. He had a solid alibi. He was nowhere around Dunwoody Prep at the time of the murder. Over the course of the next, let's say, couple weeks, obviously, they interview the widow. They start digging deep.
And one of the challenges was Rusty Snyderman, as Kathy said, he and his wife were active in synagogues. And there was a fairly concentrated population of Jewish people who lived in Dunwoody.
Right.
And so because of the way this sketch looked, because of the way this could have been
a Middle Eastern man.
Exactly. They were concerned that it might have been some sort of anti-Semitic act. I guess in the city over the last couple of years or the years prior, they had had some like swastikas painted on schools or synagogues and whatnot. So they were concerned about that.
And they found out that Rusty and Andrea owned a second home. And the next door neighbor to that second home was trying to sell their property. And the neighbor believed that Rusty was doing something to infringe on the land. I cannot remember what it was.
Build a fence or something like that.
Yeah, that there was like some sliver of their property that was actually taken. And so there was a little, I'm not going to call it a dust up, but there was an argument. There was a little dispute, exactly, between Rusty and the neighbor. But ultimately, the police cleared them very quickly. And that sort of went out the window. So they just kept looking and looking and looking. And then detectives learned that Rusty had bad blood with a former employer. And as I'm saying his name, I'm wondering, did we explain to people that Russell went by Rusty?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Same person.
Russell went by Rusty.
So Rusty, who went to Harvard for his MBA, was Russell.
Exactly. Anyway, they found out that he had bad blood with a former employer when they were looking for suspects.
So Mr. Harvard MBA, of course, is working for a company as their CFO, and he noticed that there were some irregularities with their books. It wasn't necessarily anything for him to report. He was just a little uncomfortable with how they were doing this.
Because he wasn't a snitch?
And he was on the straight and narrow.
That's like, good. I'm kidding. It's good.
I know you are. Ish.
I'm kidding a scotch.
Exactly. But because of that, he decided he had to quit. And they weren't happy that he quit because he was very forthright with them. You're not doing this correctly. I'm not in support of how you're doing this. I'm not comfortable working for you now. See, I wouldn't want to be you.
And they're probably afraid like, oh my God, he might let the cat out of the bag.
Exactly. Did he take any books?
Besmirch our good name.
Exactly. But he didn't because we don't know their good name.
Exactly.
Or bad name.
But ultimately that led nowhere.
Right. They could have had a motive. And that's what the police were looking into.
One of the things the police also looked into were prior response calls to the residents, and they noticed that within Gosh, it was within five weeks. Okay, a month prior to the murders, there were two 911 calls that went to the Dunwoody police. The first was about a month prior, and it was that Rusty and Andrea believed that somebody was trying to break into their home.
It was late at night. They were both at home, and they thought they heard somebody who was really like trying to jimmy open a door.
Police respond. They don't see anything. No harm, no foul. And I'm sure that's exactly what it said in the police report. But here's the crazy thing. 1 week before the murder, and this is after Andrea left for work, Rusty is home by himself and they have a gas leak, or they suspect that there's a gas leak. So he leaves the house and goes around the side of the home, and he is shocked to see a man crouched and hiding behind their air conditioning unit. So the guy is like, freaked out. Like he did not.
Screams like a little girl.
Exactly. He wasn't expecting to see Rusty either. And he takes off. And Rusty notices that he has a disguise on of some sort.
Right.
And so that wasn't really fleshed out. I am assuming he had some type of fake beard or whatever. So as this person ran away, Rusty told police that he thought he saw a gun in this man's back pocket. Nobody was ever picked up. But of course, Rusty was completely freaked out. This is the second time he's calling 911 in a very short time. He has no idea what's going on.
Someone creeping outside his house.
Exactly.
In a disguise.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Like a bad teen slasher flick.
Totally. Have you checked the children lately?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was a couple of weeks after the murder that the Georgia Bureau of Investigation were able to clean up this videotape from the preschool / daycare center / Dunwoody Prep. Mm-hmm. Just got to cover them all and return it to the Dunwoody Police Department. So we had mentioned that all of the witnesses were there and they were saying it was a white minivan. I saw a white minivan. There's a white minivan leaving the parking lot. Well, the Dunwoody police didn't see a white minivan. What they saw was a silver minivan. And Kathy and I were talking about this. It just goes to show how when you're witnessing something, you're not necessarily seeing what you're seeing. And, you know, like you had said,
it's like the power of
suggestion. Almost.
Exactly.
It's like the man who thought it was fake.
Overhearing. Exactly. Or overhearing somebody say it was a white minivan. In your head, you might be like, oh, I thought it was silver. No, it was white. It was white. She's right. It's white.
Exactly. You know what I mean? Had to have been white.
And so multiple people, I'm sure, said white minivan.
Right. So they get this silver minivan. It is a Kia Sedona. Turns out it's 2011. They didn't get the plate, but they were able to get the make and model. And based on this model, I guess they were also able to get the year. The detectives were like, okay, you know what? We don't know the plate. We don't know who's driving it. We have to pull a list of every single Kia Sedona registered in the state of Georgia and track these people down.
I'm trying to control my impulse to go, my Sedona.
You really didn't.
Woo! Okay, I had to get that out of my system.
She didn't control her impulse very
exactly,
well.
Exactly, exactly.
Kath, you will not believe how long this list was.
You're right.
Because I already told you.
Yes, you did.
13.
13.
There were only 13 Kia Sedonas in the state of Georgia. And it was because this is November 18th of 2010. It was a 2011 model year. So it hasn't been for sale that long. I'm guessing not a popular car either. And obviously they were shocked by the number and probably celebrating a little bit because they were going to be home for dinner.
Oh, totally. So. Exactly.
So they actually tracked down the first 12, spoke to every single one of the owners, and every single one of them had a rock solid alibi. Now, the 13th one was a little different because the owner was Enterprise Rent-A-Car. So they toddle on down to Enterprise Rent-A-Car.
Detectives do, they toddle.
And they were able to get the form from the person who rented it. Before the police reached out to Hemi Newman, the man who had rented the car, they did a little bit of research on him. They learned that he was married and had three kids. He was an engineer who was working at GE Energy. Apparently, his division had more than 1,000 employees. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping he only had a handful under him because really, it's only 7 employees that are the ideal number to manage and still be an effective manager.
I think he had like over 36.
That's crazy.
I know. I can't remember where I read that.
My Harvard MBA said
right.
7. That's what it said. He had no criminal background, never been in trouble, never had a parking ticket, anything like that, and was making about $140,000 a year. He was top management at GE Energy. They were able to get in touch with Hemi at the end of December, and he was on family vacation in Florida. So he talked to him and he said, absolutely, I rented the car. My car was having car trouble. I had to take it to the shop, needed to get to work, so I rented this van, but I was at work all day. That's my alibi. Well, it turned out that GE Energy had 8 gazillion cameras and even more locked doors because it was an energy company. So lots of secrets, lots of secrets, you know, all that kind of thing. And so he said, you know, look at the cameras. I was there all day. So of course they did. They checked when he came in, you know, they were able to track the van when he got there first thing in the morning, where he went and parked, going in to even get into the building. No matter if you're an executive or not, you had to swipe a personal key card. You had to use it to go through the elevators. Pretty much anything you did, you had to use this key card. And so not only were they able to verify he was there because of the key card, but his phone was also there all day long as well. So now they have 13 Kia Sedonas accounted for and 13 solid alibis. So who done it? Kath, as they were looking into Hemi Newman's job as the executive at GE, they stumbled onto something that just stopped them in their tracks. One of his employees was none other than the widow Snyderman, also known as Andrea. Despite Hemi's solid ironclad alibi, the popo goes back to the videotape and they start looking at the surveillance video again. And they look at thousands and thousands of hours trying to see, did Hemi Newman actually leave the building? And it turns out he did. He snuck down a stairwell using a guest access swipe card. And he snuck out the door that most of the employees used when they snuck out to take a smoke break.
There was a lot of sneaking.
There was a lot of sneaking being done. So once they see Hemi leaving the building, they now start looking at the videotapes for where's the My Sedona?
Mm-hmm. Whoa!
There you go. And they see it. And sure enough, it's driving away. So he was gone for a few hours before they see the minivan coming back, the My Sedona. And when they see him get out of the car, he is wearing the same clothes that he wore when he snuck out of the building in the sneaky spot last time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he goes through the front entrance, once again, he needs to enter the building. He again is using a guest swipe card to do it. So now they need to have a conversation with Mr. Newman and find out what all this sneaking and snucking was all about.
Exactly. So Hemi was very much like an engineer, exactly yes. What you'd expect. Like he and my father-in-law would have been two peas in a pod.
Yes, they would have been.
And so,
in the best of ways.
Exactly. So Hemi's pretty relaxed. He seems kind of chill. And then there's this one detective who starts going and going and going. In this interview, they're asking him questions about Andrea, their work relationship. He's asking questions about text messages to her.
Phone calls.
Yep. You know, they're getting into it.
Business trips.
Correct. And they're painting a picture of a man who was very much into Rusty Snyderman's wife.
And his subordinate at work.
His subordinate at work and the man who gave her a job. And so I saw basically an interview, essentially. Andrea Snyderman was saying that she had been at home with the kids. And then at some point, I think she was working from home, but she hadn't been in the workplace in a few years, is my understanding.
Which makes sense.
Right. And so she, going back into the workforce, was a little bit nervous about it, but she got this job at a good company and she was very appreciative of Hemi Newman and grateful for having this opportunity to work at a good company. And I think she had a decent salary. I think she made like
120,
something like that.
Back in 2010 money.
$120,000. That was like really good caja.
Yeah.
The police are painting him as a man who is unhappy in his own marriage, experiencing financial problems. At the time of this interview, he had been, I believe, separated from his wife for a month. He left his wife, moved into like a residence inn or something like that for a period of time, and then wound up staying with a friend. His kids were in college. They were extended on credit. They were just having a difficult patch financially. And so the detectives were pressing him. You liked Andrea Snyderman. You know, were you having an affair with her? That kind of stuff. No. So they were doing a lot of investigative work behind the scenes, and they knew there were a lot of text messages between Andrea and Hemi. They knew there were a lot of emails. And again, she was his subordinate. So they were also aware that they had work trips together.
Yeah, they worked very closely together.
Exactly. And so there was more than an implication of a romantic relationship. They also found out that Hemi Newman had purchased a .40 caliber pistol. And this was about 7 months before the murder. At some point in this interview, the detectives asked him point blank, "Did you murder Rusty Snyderman?" And there was silence. So Hemi Newman was arrested on the day he was interviewed, and it was a very, very lengthy interview. Detectives then seized the iPad and the cell phone that he had with him at the time, and of course, wound up doing a phone dump. Leading up to his arrest and trial, I want to go back to the .40 caliber pistol. They find out that he purchased it from a man, like I said, roughly 7 months before the murder. Hemi went to a website. It was totally like Guns for Us, but it wasn't that. But it was something very, very obvious. And it was for people who wanted to, you know, sell guns to each other. And he actually took a gun safety class. But anyway, he purchases this gun from a man named Jan. I don't know. I feel like they called him Jan, but it was probably technically Jan. You know, but anyway, so he purchased the gun, and it was a unique gun. It was like Bersa or something like that, B-E-R-S-A. Hemi Newman was not intimately familiar with guns. And so he was at the firing range. I believe he was with the gun seller at the time. So he goes to fire a round, and a bullet casing is ejected, which he didn't know what happened. So apparently it surprised him. And so the gun seller, Jan or Jan, depending on who you want to talk to, picked up the casing and put it in his pocket. And Jan, for whatever reason, or Jan, what should we call him? They were calling him Jan, so let's just call him Jan. Okay, fine,
but there's no way this man is called Jan.
I agree with you.
But if everyone called him Jan, we will be Southern today and call him Jan.
Marsha.
Exactly.
So anyway, at some point after the murder, Hemi goes back to Jan. These names cannot be made up.
Yes, exactly.
And says, "Hey, by the way, something happened with my gun, and if the police come to you, I just want you to lie about it. I want to let you know that I threw the gun in the river, but I want you to lie about it, and I'll give you some money." And so he offers Jan money.
Do you know how much?
I don't. I don't know how much.
But I couldn't find that, but I was dying to know.
Yeah, but Jan's like, "I'll totally lie for you. Don't worry about it. And I don't need your money.
No cash required."
No cash required. Exactly. Lies are for free. Turns out Jan was lying about that to Hemi.
Of course.
So he goes and he gets the bullet casing that he had given to his girlfriend.
That's random.
It's so random. Like, why did you give your girlfriend a bullet casing? But whatever. Anyway, so detectives were able to match that casing to those found at the scene where Rusty Snyderman was murdered.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Police and prosecutors are now focused on Hemi and Andrea's relationship.
Now, this is based on the text messages and emails they received, right?
Exactly.
Or they recovered. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
And one of the things that they realized was that on Andrea's computer, 2 days before her husband was killed, she was researching information on her husband's death benefits, which were $2 million. What I do not know, and which is very important, is whether it was a home computer or her laptop. Because what we find out is that on the day that Rusty was killed and the day that Hemi was sneaking around through the building with a guest pass, he took Andrea's computer home or away from the office. And so I have no idea if this search was on her computer at work or her home computer, but...
But he did this after Rusty was killed, though, correct?
Correct. I don't know if he was trying to hide her computer. I just don't know.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
But we also know that Hemi was searching. He looked up the value of their homes on Zillow. He looked up a map of Dunwoody Preschool/Prep/
daycare slash Harvard feeder school, I'm right. pretty sure.
Exactly. And he also looked up psychiatric privileged information, what a psychiatrist was not allowed to reveal. So ultimately, police decided that they believe that Andrea was involved somehow in her husband's murder. And one of the key factors was that she apparently did not tell police that she believed Hemi Newman was the killer, even though she felt in her gut and shared with her three closest friends, I believe, right. I know he's the one. I know he's the one. But when asked to provide a list of people or potential suspects or somebody who could do this, she initially did not say his name.
But provided like five or six others.
And then ultimately, over a month after her husband's murder, and frankly, very shortly before Hemi was arrested, you know, they asked again, like, who do you think could have done this? And she gave the name Hemi Newman. So she ultimately coughed it up. Hemi pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. He claimed to have bipolar disorder and hallucinations and said that he was being visited by a demon, or said that he had been visited by a demon and an angel. He said this black demon came to him and he told Hemi something like that he would see him soon, something like that. He told him something. I can't remember specifically what the message was. And Hemi took it as, I am supposed to kill myself. What he did was he said, okay, I'm going to kill myself. But then he wound up not doing it because he knew it was a grave sin, something like that. He wanted to stay away from that. He was visited by a second apparition, and this was well before the murders. And the second apparition was an angel in white who sounded like Olivia Newton-John.
I wonder if she was singing Xanadu.
Exactly. This angel supposedly tells Hemi that Rusty Snyderman was going to harm his wife and harm his children, and he had to be stopped. And so Hemi took it upon himself.
And there was only one way to stop him.
Correct. To kill Rusty Snyderman in order to protect Rusty's family.
So as Kathy said, Hemi Newman pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. And of course, prosecutors were skeptical about this because he had never shown any psychiatric problems throughout his life. He was incredibly intelligent. He was very successful at work. He was married and had children and all of this. Nothing had ever shown that he maybe had a break of some sort. But when trial started, Hemi shocked them once again by saying, I did it. I confessed to the murder, but it's due to the mental disease or defect. So because Hemi confessed, trial now became all about his mental state at the time Rusty Snyderman was killed. Trial began on February 21st of 2012, not even a year and a half after Rusty Snyderman was murdered. And Kath, I know you saw this too, but I was watching a film of the opening statement that the prosecutor gave. And he was a former Marine pilot. He was older. Were we going to put him in his late 50s, early 60s?
I would say early 60s.
Okay. I was going to say that, but I thought you were going to then be like, no, he wasn't. He wasn't that old.
He looked super young at heart.
He was. He felt it. But he gets up. He's talking very slowly, gravelly voice, and he is describing for the jury how Rusty Snyderman was killed. He says, Hemi Newman got out of his car, raised his gun, walks over to Rusty, and shoots him here and here and here, like pointing to different parts of the body. And Rusty falls to the ground, bleeding profusely, dying. But that wasn't good enough for Hemi Newman. He walks over to Rusty's body, on his back, arms and legs splayed out,
gasping for breath.
And he lowers his body and puts his gun on Rusty's jugular and fires a .40 caliber hollow point bullet into Rusty Snyderman's neck. I got chills.
I know. Kathy could not stop talking about this opening.
And nothing I saw had actually even said they were hollow point bullets. Right. I mean, it would have been bad enough anyway. Like, a bullet is a bullet.
Exactly.
But to know that these were hollow points to begin with, mm-hmm. and then it was a hollow point then that went into the neck.
Right.
He signed his death certificate.
But the prosecutor did a good job of drawing out every single intentional step. And he was doing this to say, listen, this guy wasn't mentally ill. This was planned. He prepared. It was calculated. The fact that he used a guest pass to get in and out of his office. The fact that he intentionally left his cell phone where he knew it would ping, not near the school.
He snuck out several times.
The fact that he, yeah, exactly. The fact that he rented a vehicle. All of the intentional steps leading up to this murder, the prosecution did a very good job of that. I believe at the time the law was the same, like you and I looked it up.
Right.
And to be insane, to be legally insane, you have to not know or not appreciate the difference between right and wrong, or have like such a mental defect / hallucinations that your will is overcome. He was talking about seeing demons, seeing angels, having these hallucinations and being compelled to kill Rusty
Against
Snyderman.
Against his will almost.
Exactly. So again, the prosecution sort of like try to do like a really step by step by step analysis of everything he did that took planning to commit this murder. And the prosecution also brought out the fact that the Newmans were having financial problems that we had spoken of earlier. And that Hemi Newman was, I don't think they used the word obsessed in opening statement, but very much into a woman. I don't think they identified Andrea Snyderman
Not
in opening statement.
Mm-hmm.
Andrea Snyderman was present in the court the entire time until she got kicked out, which we'll get into in a minute. Court TV had a lot of this, and it's like, some very compelling testimony is happening and they pan to the widow. You know what I mean? Like there was just a lot of that going on. And so you had this vibe that when she was sitting in the gallery and the cameras were on her, you could tell. I felt like she was like authentic. You know what I mean? And
as Kathy just said, the prosecution told the jury about Hemi's financial problems and his marital problems and even kind of suggested Hemi might be having an affair. Now, a friend of Hemi's testified for the prosecution that he had told her about his relationship with another woman, and that other woman, according to Hemi, was Andrea Snyderman, Rusty's widow. And so this friend, what she was saying is that I guess Hemi and Andrea traveled together a lot for business. And the friend was recalling a certain trip that they took to London together, they, Andrea and Hemi, and how Hemi was describing these kind of romantic off trips that they would take together. At night, they would plan these romantic excursions and things like that. He admitted to this woman, and that was the person testifying, it was a female friend, that he and Andrea had decided together that they were soulmates, but that Andrea was adamant that she would never leave her husband and children. But because of this information, the prosecution looked quite a bit, as we had said, into emails and text messages between Hemi and Andrea. And there were a lot of things that made it appear as if they actually were having an affair. Neither one of them ever said that they were.
No, I think before trial, he did say, according to the reports, actually, according to some of the Court of Appeal opinions, he said he was having an affair with Andrea. However, there was no reference in the record that I saw in the appellate opinions what that meant. You know, like clearly they were having an affair of the heart kind of thing. However,
did it include sex?
According to him, it did. But I didn't see any greater detail than that. I mean, like, I don't think it was an ongoing thing. He told another friend that while they were away on a trip, Andrea gave in. And so the friend testified on the stand. Well, she was asked, what did you take that to mean? And she's like, that they had intercourse. And so they're getting into all of this stuff about their relationship, but it was not from Hemi, who, you know, he did not take the stand during the trial. And at this point, Andrea had not been put on the stand.
So I think what they were trying to do, though, and what the prosecutor had said, is that as part of this insanity plea, if Hemi was in love with Andrea And if he was having marital and money problems and Rusty has a convenient $2 million death benefit, that he can't claim insanity if he was doing it for love and money.
Right.
Because clearly he'd planned very well and very accurately.
Right. He was an engineer.
What he was trying to do. Exactly. Yeah. They were bringing these people to the stand going, nope, they were doing it.
Right.
But some of the things that came out, though, Kathy, one of the things, because Kathy and I were talking about this, both of us have had bosses who we absolutely got along with. Had to travel with them, loved it, had fun. They were saying things like, do you always share a romantic bottle of wine at dinner? Well, we drank with our bosses, and it has nothing to do with romance. It has to do with the fact that the office is paying for the alcohol.
Right.
So, and it was a nice bottle of wine.
Yeah, exactly. So Andrea took the stand at trial, and it was her understanding that she was trying to help the prosecution show that Hemi Newman was not crazy. And so when she took the stand, she felt very ambushed. She was on the stand for hours answering questions about
very belligerently
emails, text messages, all these things that she didn't really prepare for or anticipate. And so she denied that they had an affair. And then she admitted that, you know, Hemi had sent her a poem on one occasion. And that's when she knew he had really, you know, romantic feelings. She said that he sent her, I think, flowers, but she was not expecting to be attacked as somebody
who
may have participated in her own husband's murder.
But wait a second, really quickly, though, what I was getting at with the bosses thing is that one of the things, though, that did come out at trial is that when Hemi and Andrea traveled together, boss and employee, they had connecting rooms.
Weird.
Very weird.
Yeah.
Because I preferred to be on a different floor from my boss. Right. Just loved him, had fun. It was great. But no.
Yeah.
And so there were some of the things that, you know,
like, no, they definitely had feelings for each other. They were supposedly each other's soulmates, all that kind of stuff. Right. They were attracted to each other. It was clear. They had affection for one another.
But we don't know how far it did or did not go.
Exactly. Because Andrea denies it. And Hemi at least told one person they did at one time, you know, so who knows? But all of the relationship information is important because then what the prosecutors do is they essentially start accusing her of being a co-conspirator in her husband's death without actually saying those words.
Exactly.
They ask her questions like, isn't it true that you told Hemi Newman about the path behind your house? And that's the path he took when he came to your house a week before the murder and was hiding behind the air conditioning unit.
Isn't it true that you told three of your best friends right away that you thought Hemi Newman killed your husband, but you didn't tell police that? You gave them five or six other people to look at before 5-6 weeks go by and you finally say, oh, it could have been this guy.
Yeah.
And they, why were you protecting him?
That's what the thing was. Like, you were protecting him.
Right.
And isn't it true you deleted emails, you deleted text messages from your BlackBerry, which was a controversial topic because there was an expert that said, hey, sometimes BlackBerries actually delete the oldest messages, blah, blah, blah. So who knows? But all of this was like, boom, boom, boom. Anyway, and then they did the kicker.
Yeah, this was the prosecution's mic drop moment. When Andrea's on the stand, they say to her, when did you find out that your husband had been shot? And she said, not until I got to the hospital. She said she got this phone call from the preschool. She flipped out, of course, gets into her car and just drives straight to the hospital. So she gets to the hospital and she talks to a doctor. And she said she's put in this room that she calls the room of death because this doctor comes in and says to her, your husband has been shot and he's dead. And she said, I didn't know him. He didn't know me. It was very cold. All I remember is falling to my knees, disbelieving of what I'm being told. And she's like, I don't remember anything else that happened that day. Don't remember what he said. I don't remember what I said. Don't ask. I have nothing to say to that. She just established when she found out that her husband was shot. So then comes this bombshell witness. And the woman is described as Andrea's best friend, Shauna. Shauna gets on the stand and they ask her two pivotal questions for the prosecution. One of them was, did you ask Andrea if she was having an affair with Hemi Newman? And she said, we did discuss it. And she said, what did Andrea say to you? Did she say she was having an affair or did she deny it? And Shauna said she denied it. The prosecutor said to her, did you believe her? And Shauna said, in my heart, I wanted to. And the prosecutor said, did you believe her? And she just shook her head and very quietly said, no. Then they said, when did Andrea tell you that her husband had been shot? And she said, after Andrea got the news about her husband and she got into her car at work, she called me and she told me, "I'm on my way to the hospital. My husband was shot." The prosecutor said, "Are you sure this is when she told you, before she got to the hospital?" And Shauna said, "Yes, I'm 100% sure." And he essentially said to the jury, I believe, at this point, the only person who would have known that information was Hemi Newman. So she's lying. Again, she's protecting him.
Exactly. And on her cell phone, she had called Hemi Newman a number of times that day.
On her way to the hospital, too.
So, and on her way to the hospital, I mean, she called a bunch of people.
Right.
She didn't call her husband's phone. So the prosecution made hay out of that. When Andrea was on the stand, she made a terrible presentation. She was stiff. She was controlled. She was overly composed.
She was also antagonistic.
She was like answering the questions angrily. It was clear that she was not prepared to be on the stand and being cross-examined. And so she was pissed. She was taking great umbrage. Because she was such a harsh witness to like watch and an awkward witness to watch, I just think she was a very unlikable character. But I don't know if it was fair to, like, she was completely eaten up in the media. It reminded me of that case, you know, the dingo ate my baby.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to do that case now.
Yeah. And so.
But Kathy won't do the accent.
Oh, I'll do it.
Or sing my Sedona.
But she was she was in the dingo ate my baby case. The mom was on the stand and she was incredibly unsympathetic and incredibly businesslike. And the jury hated her guts. Andrea made a terrible witness. So yeah, the prosecution attacked her and essentially called her a co-conspirator without really calling her a co-conspirator.
Right. 14 days of testimony, 2 days of deliberation, and the jury comes back with a verdict on Hemi Newman.
Guilty, but they did find that he had a mental defect. So he was not going to be spending time in prison. He was not going to be gen-popping it. He was going to be
in prison, but just not gem popping it.
But like he'll be in a psych ward.
Right. And he was sentenced to
LWOP.
LWOP.
Kathy's favorite.
And if you don't know what it means, you need to listen to more episodes.
One of the things the jurors asked the prosecutor when all was said and done, because the attorneys always interview the jurors, they said, "Why didn't you charge her with her husband's murder?" So what happens? They do. They charge her with murder, they charge her with aggravated assault, and they charge her with perjury.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there was another
obstruction.
One. Obstruction of justice. Almost their entire case was based on her testimony in the trial.
So as Kathy said, she was charged with murder, but the day before her trial begins, the district attorney dropped the murder charge, but it did go forward on the perjury and obstruction charges.
Right. Drop the murder and drop the aggravated assault.
So 13 charges for perjury and obstruction. She was convicted of 9 of those 13 charges and received a 5-year sentence, served 9 months before being paroled. And this was because they gave her credit for time served in both jail and she was under house arrest before the trial started. And her parole conditions were met in August of 2017. What I learned is that in the state of Georgia, they have a First Offender Act, which means that if you are a first-time offender and you do the time after you did the crime and you serve your parole and or probation, as soon as you are cleared off of that, they wipe it entirely off the books as if it never even happened. So that's what happened with her. Nothing on the books in Georgia about being convicted of anything. And after she was off her parole, apparently she didn't have probation after that. She changed her name, moved out of state. The public does not know where she is.
And so as to Hemi Newman, he appealed his verdict because he said, "You admitted information in the trial that was subject to the attorney-client privilege," and he was correct. His attorneys had hired experts on his behalf, and you're allowed to hire consultants to help you develop your case. And as long as you don't call them as your expert witnesses, that information remains privileged. Well, the prosecution found out that his attorneys had sent him to 2 psychiatrists and were using them as consultants, and they subpoenaed the records. And his attorneys were like, "You can't do that. Those are our secret privilege. They're agents. They're part of my expert team that's helping me prepare for trial." And they tried to quash the subpoenas and the judge just basically said, nay, nay, fair maiden, good luck, peace out. Prosecution got the records and the Court of Appeal was like, wait a second, you can't do that. You can't subpoena the records of a consultant hired by the attorney. That's part of the privilege. So he gets a new trial and it didn't go so well for him the second time around because what they do is the jury finds him guilty. However, with no mental defect, no mental problem, no insanity defense. They totally reject that. They just toss that out. So now he's bummed. He's in general population. So he appeals that and he says, wait a second. They already found me crazy. You can't do that. You know, blah, 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 whatever. And the Court of Appeals like, no.
It was actually the Supreme Court.
Oh,
the Georgia Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court.
So the Georgia Supreme Court apparently said, nope. You had a second trial. It was a fair trial. The jury is entitled to reject your insanity defense. So you are now in Gen Pop.
And again, he was sentenced to
LWOP.
Okay. Right.
See you next time.
Hopefully.
If you want to support the channel, just click subscribe.
And ask all your friends to do the same.
And send us the cases you would like us to cover.
Yes, please. This one was actually from a listener. Tragically, yep. I could not find the email, so I don't know who it was.
But we thank you very much.
Yes, absolutely. Deep down in our hearts where it counts.
And we're going to find the email and we're going to thank you at a later date.
Yes. All right. Peace out.
Peace out.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.